everyone. This is episode one of Title Talk, presented by Entering Title Town. I'm your host, Jordan Haddock. And I thank everyone for clicking on the podcast, giving it a listen. I hope it will be one you come back to. And if you have followed us on Entering Title Town, you know that we have been teasing this podcast for a while, and we have finally brought it to you guys. And if you're just stumbling upon us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, welcome as well. Be sure to check out our Instagram page, Entering Title Town, where we post news, analysis, discussion on a daily basis about all things Boston sports. So just a quick preview of what this podcast is really going to be about. We're pretty much going to discuss what we post. Everything that we throw up on the Instagram page will certainly be a topic of discussion in the podcast. And we think that we can kind of give our opinions and create more of a community by doing this. And we think that it'll be really enjoyable for us and really enjoyable for you guys. And we certainly look forward to keeping this running for as long as you guys listen. So let's start this episode off with really what everyone's talking about in the Boston sports world, and that's the Boston Red Sox. It's certainly baseball season in July. We just came to the end of the quote-unquote mid-season, quote-unquote the first half of the season, I should say, where the Red Sox certainly had a bit of a slip-up towards the end. Instead of rolling into the All-Star break in a wild card spot, or in a playoff spot rather, they sit outside, having lost a back-to-back series to the Tampa Bay Rays and the New York Yankees to end it. They sit at 48-45 in fourth place in the AL East, which doesn't really tell the whole story, as the AL East, as we know, is quite a powerful division. But it's safe to say that the Sox are in a tough spot now. They've yet to win a single series against the AL East in this first half. And they are certainly not doing great in the tiebreaker category, especially with the Rays and the Blue Jays both seemingly going to be fighting until the end for a wildcard spot as well. If it comes down to head-to-head, we're in a bit of trouble. So, you know, there's no denying that the Sox are have been disappointing in the past month or so. After a strong June, the July has been just that. The amount of good that June was has been the amount of bad that July was. And with the trade deadline approaching, the Sox find themselves in a spot they've been in before, where they're kind of on the line of buyer and seller. On one hand, if you're in favor of them buying, you know, the city of Boston isn't a big fan of not competing for the playoffs. You find yourself just a couple of games outside of the wild card. And we all know that when this team gets going, they're one of the best. So the argument for you know, being a buyer is that, you know, if you had an extra bullpen arm, if you had an extra starter, you might be a little bit closer, you know, to that 55-ish win mark instead of the 48 you're at, just because of how many games the bullpen and the pitching has blown. On the contrary, the Sox have a lot of players this offseason that are set to become free agents. Kike Hernandez, JD Martinez, Xander Bogaerts at the moment, Nathan Eovaldi, Nick Pivetta, just to name a few. And all of those guys, especially the JD Martinez and Xander Bogaerts, would fetch a lot of value at the deadline. And so the argument for a seller would be, you've got the New York Yankees, you got the Houston Astros, and frankly, you have the Rays and the Blue Jays, who have all proven that they are a better team than you this year. Do you think you can really have a realistic shot at even making the World Series? And it's a real question, and that's, you know, really where the Sox stand, and the Sox have to, you know, really look at, self-reflect and look at if their team is really good enough. I find myself leaning more towards the buyer just because we talked about how strong the AL East has been this year. When you have to face the Yankees, the Blue Jays, and the Rays so many times in the first half of the season, and with the past 2 weeks having faced the Rays twice and the Yankees twice as well, I kind of expected the Sox to have to bite the bullet a little bit. Certainly, they should have won a couple of the ones they let slip away, but I don't think it's enough for me to push them towards selling off a lot of their cornerstones and giving up on the year just yet. Now, they have a stretch, I believe, of about 10 games before the deadline. They have a series against the Blue Jays, the Guardians, and the Brewers, I believe, and then that is kind of marks the end until the trade deadline. So there's about 9 to 10 games there that they can really pick it up and certainly turn the tide and turn a lot of opinions about what this team can is capable of if they go 8-2 in that stretch, or I think it's 9 games. So if they go 7-2 in that stretch and get right back into the wild card spot, you're going to see them. A lot of people flip onto the buyer side, and rightfully so. However, if they drop 5 of those 9, and they can't really run into the trade deadline with their head down, ready to bulldoze that second half of the season, there's a lot more conversation that needs to be had, and I think certainly there would be more discussion around whether they should sell off or not. And I actually just noticed that. The deadline is pushed back this year. I forgot about that. So they've got a few more games than just the ones I named. But, beside the point, they've got to do really well in the stretch up to the deadline after the All-Star break. A lot of the games are at home, and a lot of the games are against teams that they're going to need to compete with if they want to make the playoffs. So it's really put up or shut up for the Sox now. This next 10-game, 15-game stretch could really determine a lot, not just about this season. But at the course of the franchise. And next episode, we'll go a little bit more in depth with what type of moves they might want to make at the deadline. We'll have a little bit more of a clearer picture regarding whether the Sox are buyers or sellers. And then we can kind of look at what we want from our guys or what we want to add to a playoff team to make this second half a fun second half for the Sox. So the Sox come into Sunday's game against the Yankees, having dropped the second game of that series by, I believe, what it was, 13 runs, losing 14-1, getting really embarrassed in Yankee Stadium. And but frankly, with the chance to salvage what was a really bad 2-week stretch in July, and if you could have stolen that game in Yankee Stadium on Sunday. You take 2 out of 3 from the Yankees. You go into the break with a win under your belt, and you've finally gotten rid of that burden that is no wins against the AL East, no series wins against the AL East in the first half of the season. But not only did the Sox once again get embarrassed in Yankee Stadium, they seemingly lost their best pitcher for the season. Chris Sale, if you weren't watching, took a line drive, a comebacker, off his hand. And the diagnosis that came out recently, within the past 24 hours, is that he had surgery on his left pinky finger and that it was open reduction and internal fixation of the left fifth finger. It was a fracture. There was an orthopedic surgeon on Twitter who kind of described the injury to everyone when it happened. He pretty much said this can range anywhere from he's back in a couple of weeks to he's out for the year. And he emphasized that if it's a fracture, there's a likelihood that Sale won't see any more time this season with the Red Sox. And it turns out it was a fracture. Sale's going to be shut down for at least a month. I believe the timeline was 4 to 6 weeks of not even pitching at all. So the likelihood of him coming back until, late September, mid-September is extremely unlikely. So think of it as with the entire month of August, you will not have Chris Sale. That is almost a guarantee. And quite frankly, when it happened, I kind of thought, you know what, this may have just sent us into the seller's market. And that was kind of an adverse reaction, but with how badly we needed Chris Sale and how badly Red Sox fans waited for this return and marked it on their calendars and were excited to see their ace back. The fact that he has one start against the Rays and then goes into Yankee Stadium with the chance to steal a series and gets a line drive off the finger in a ridiculously unlucky play, it sucks. And the Chris Sale saga continues in Boston. The injury woes continue. Obviously, this one is not his fault, but it's still extremely detrimental to a team that needs pitching badly and will now probably have to go out and get a starter or get a long reliever and give up some prospects instead of just taking what they have off of the IL in Sale. He's now going to spend another good portion of the season injured. We posted earlier today some midseason superlatives for the Sox, and I wanted to quickly go over them and just give my reasoning with each one because it did prompt some discussion, which is what I like. And everyone had great points in the comments, and there's certainly some there are a number of players that you could have marked down for each one, but I wanted to just give you guys my reasoning so you don't think I just pulled it out of somewhere and had nothing behind it, no evidence behind it. So there were three superlatives that we listed. We had most surprising, most disappointing, and the second half X factor. So who you think is going to have play a significant role in that second half and really either help the Red Sox get to the playoffs or be the reason why they don't. So for the most surprising, I took this as someone who I thought coming into the season was going to be a lesser version of what they are now. Now, some people in the comments were saying the bullpen. Yeah, the bullpen would work for that because, frankly, they were expected to be better than this and that, and they've been abysmal. So they're surprising, but in a bad way. But I went the other route, and so my pick was Tanner Houck. He's been really loved in Boston for a good while now. Ever since he's come up, I think a lot of Boston kind of sees Chris Sale in him, his demeanor. Hey, the way he works, the speed at which he works. Obviously, he's on the flip side as a righty, but he really brought a great energy to the team. And even though he shows zero emotion, Sox fans know that he cares deeply about the team, and he certainly wants to help them win and perform at a high level. And the fact that he was pretty much thrown into the bullpen because we didn't have any other options. And he was thrown into the closer role, not just a simple long reliever, throw me the six and seven. Now he's come in with Aaron Judge up, down a run or up a run with the runners on the corners. That's a huge ask for a guy who didn't close in his in his short career. And I think that if you just look back at what type of team, what type of record we might have without Tanner Houck, it just shows that he's been so important to the team. And even with his vaccine status being a problem with going to Toronto, if you just look at the games that he has been around and he has been able to pitch, he's helped us in a number of ways. And I think more so that he just was able to transition really easily to the bullpen, and that helped us tremendously. And if you really look at how our bullpen would look without Houck, we'd be in a lot of trouble because Schreiber would be that closer. You wouldn't really have a two. You certainly wouldn't have any relief in the middle innings. And he's just been a fantastic addition to a bullpen that was really on the brink of collapse in the early part of the season. The next superlative that we have was most disappointing. And this one seemed to ruffle some feathers. A lot of people had a problem with who I picked. A lot of people had great choices. I saw Trevor Story, which is a good one. He got paid a lot of money to be a great player, and he's been mediocre. I saw Xander Bogaerts was one that came up, and Xander on a contract year all certainly hasn't performed. Garrett Whitlock was thrown in, but I kind of wanted to avoid guys in the IL because it's not necessarily their fault. But the one that I mentioned that I didn't see mentioned much at all was Alex Verdugo. And I think recency bias played a part in this. A lot of people just remember that game tying and game winning hits that he had against the Yankees. And people like to just say, well, look at that right there. And he had a hot stretch in July and in the late part of June, and that's all right. But I think with where Verdugo ended the season last year, he hit just above 330 from August 1st on into the last game of the regular season. He was a really huge part of us getting into the playoffs, and I think with where he finished, I expected a bigger jump. I expected a bigger leap. And frankly, I think he's taken a step back. He's hitting just above 260. His home run numbers, his RBI numbers are certainly lining up well. But I think his advanced metrics, his WAR has now dipped into the negatives. While you have guys like Devers, Bogaerts, and Story with a high number in the WAR category. So, I don't want to be that advanced metric guy who doesn't watch who people think don't watch games, and that's not what I am. But I also think Verdugo gave us all a taste of what we all know he can be capable of last season, and he's definitely taken a step back this year when we could have really used the help with Trevor Story and Xander Bogaerts being very mediocre this season. So that's my reasoning for Verdugo. I understand the pushback. It's not the easiest one to defend, but I do believe it. And so we now end with the second half X factor. And this one was rather new for me. Chris Sale going down, like we just talked about, really opened the door for a lot of guys to become that X factor. And I think the guy it opens the door most for is Nathan Eovaldi, who has dealt with injuries this year as well. Who has just recently returned and who we know has the ability to win ball games by himself, as we saw in the AL wild card with how he pitched against the Yankees. He's got that fight in him. He has the correct channeling of emotions that you want from a starter, from a pitcher, and he's frankly going to have to become the number one in this second half of the season because of Sale's injury. So while he had a bit of a cushion with Sale going down, it's been taken away. He's the number one. He's going to have to show up, and he's going to have to be the guy to go win us those big games late in the season when we're in Toronto, when we're playing the Yankees, when we're trying to squeak out a win against the Guardians or the Mariners. He's going to have to be that guy, and we'll see if it happens, and we'll see if he can maintain that for a long stretch. But I think Nate Eovaldi really holds the balance of the Red Sox season in his hands. If he pitches well, I think this team can certainly push their way into the postseason. But without him, you have an extremely underwhelming pitching rotation and a starting in a bullpen that cannot carry games for you, and that frankly you'll run into a lot of trouble in a majority of the games. So that's my take on the Sox. We'll certainly, like I said, have more next week on the trade deadline coming up and where the Sox sit, either on the buyer or seller bench. And so we'll discuss more about them in the next episode. What I assumed after the Game 6 loss in the NBA Finals to the Golden State Warriors was that the Celtics would return roughly the same squad, maybe replace a couple of bench pieces, but that core and a lot of the 6-7 guys on the bench would be back, and it wouldn't be much of a change. And why would you need to change it? You just got to the finals. You just had a really tough playoff fight where you pretty much faced all of the best teams in the East in that run. But instead, Brad Stevens seemed to think just the opposite and decided that not only was he going to make a move rather quickly, but that it was going to be a huge splash and quite possibly the biggest trade of the NBA offseason when he acquired Malcolm Brogdon for a first round pick next year, Daniel Tice, and a bunch of bench misfits. That was a massive, sorry, and Aaron Nesmith. I don't want to throw him in that category, but that was a massive splash, and it was one that I didn't expect. There's a lot of discussion back then about the Evan Fournier TPE that has since expired, but that maybe that would be used to acquire, a guy that could come off the bench. But in no way did I think Malcolm Brogdon was going to be an option. Obviously, Indiana is trying to sell off a lot of their guys. They attempted to get DeAndre Ayton. It doesn't look like that's going to happen, but they're going through a rebuild. Malcolm Brogdon doesn't necessarily fit what they're trying to do, and they'll take first round picks whenever they can get them. However, the fact that we were able to acquire, a 20 point per game guard who just won Rookie of the Year in his first season, was a phenomenal player on the Bucks, a 50 40 90 guy on the Bucks, and who was simply just pushed back by injuries and in Indiana and really never got going for pretty much nothing. I mean, a first round pick and really nothing. Not to I'm not trying to take any credit away from Daniel Tice, Aaron Nesmith, and those guys, but none of them were key pieces. None of them were going to be key pieces next year. And you've now acquired a star guard who is likely going to push his way into the starting lineup. And if not, he'll get starting caliber minutes with Marcus and with Derek White and with Peyton Pritchard. A couple things come out of this trade. One, a lot of discussion about whether the Celtics are going to go into the season with all of these guards under roster. You just heard me name the four that will see a lot of minutes. And obviously, Jaylen Brown will probably run at the two and three. But my take on it is I think they're going to come into the season with that depth at guard. With how the injuries plagued us during the playoffs and last season as a whole, I certainly don't think Brad Stevens is going to attempt to get rid of any depth. It's not like they're struggling for cap. Wick and the entire ownership group are willing to spend. They have obviously proven that with the acquisition of Brogdon. And I don't think you need to be worrying too much about hey, having a surplus of guards. I'd rather have more than not enough. And the other take from this was that, well, what does the starting lineup look like in the next season? And that's still a question mark. I don't think anyone truly knows. There's rumors that Brogdon is going to be the sixth man, and the starting lineup is frankly not going to change from last year. It will be Marcus Smart with Jaylen Brown, Tatum, Al, and Rob. I'm okay with that. And there have also been rumors that say you might see Al Horford be relegated to the bench. He's getting older. He might play less minutes and have Tatum pushed to the four, Brown to the three, and then have Brogdon and Smart as the two guards. I'm less in favor of that because I think Brogdon and Smart play really similar games. I think I'm not sure they'd complement each other as much as people expected. I'd rather see them, kind of alternating minutes. I think Brogdon does best when he is the point guard, and I think Smart does best when he is the point guard. Relegating either of those two to the two as the second guard, I don't love it. You'll certainly see them play minutes together, but I don't think a starting rotation with both of them in it is what the Celtics need. But it's a good problem to have. The Celtics, like I said, struggled with injuries last season. Derek White had his share. Oh, he had, obviously he had his kid during the playoffs. We needed guys to step up for that. Smart had his ankle injury. Adding another guard like Malcolm Brogdon not only helps the depth, but frankly, it gives you another scorer. It gives you another key piece in the title run that we hope occurs next season. And there simply is no negative takeaways from this deal. I applaud Brad Stevens. He's done exactly what everyone hoped he would do. He did what Ainge was scared to do. And it's the Brad Stevens era in Boston has been an A plus. I'm not going to touch too much on this point because it's kind of simmered down since the start of the offseason or even midway through the offseason. Now that we've gotten Summer League started and the draft is over, it seems like these discussions have pretty much become obsolete. But everyone knows that Kevin Durant was involved in a lot of rumors over the past couple of months, many of them sending him to Boston with Jaylen Brown going the other way. We've posted about this before with how we feel about it. But I just simply don't understand those who are in favor of trading one of your two best players when you just made the NBA Finals and lost to possibly the greatest dynasty this game's ever seen. It's not like you just got second rounded by a team you should have beat. It's not like you didn't make the playoffs, like it's not like you finished the season where you were in December when you were fighting for a play-in spot. This is a team that's shown that they can win with Jaylen Brown and Jayson Tatum as their best two players. Brad Stevens has done a great job, as we mentioned, with in the previous segment with acquiring Malcolm Brogdon, another great passing point guard that will complement the Jays greatly. And I think it's a bit of a panic from Celtics fans, a bit of a push of the panic button from Celtics fans for really no good reason. And I think it's simply because of the name value. I think Kevin Durant warrants acknowledgement whenever he's put on the market. And I don't necessarily fault any Celtics fans for that. But at the same time, I don't th I think they're blinded by Kevin Durant right now. And I think that they're not recognizing and they're not being transparent with how well the Celtics team performed last year and how close we came to an NBA Finals. So instead of us trading Jaylen Brown and picks and this and that for an aging Kevin Durant, who has done nothing but bring toxicity to franchises since his departure from OKC, why don't we just take the Brogdon trade, add that in, look at the roster as a whole? We bring back the exact same guys. This is the team that got us to the NBA Finals. Throw in Malcolm Brogdon, another star guard. This team is destined for 60 wins. It's destined for a number one seed, and it's destined for another NBA Finals appearance. So there's a couple months until the season starts. We kind of already know the makeup of the team, and I'm glad these KD rumors have passed, and that is pretty much obsolete at this point, and that it's simply not going to happen. I was never truly worried, but I'm so glad that where the Celtics stand right now is where they're going to be at the beginning of the season. We'll obviously have more discussion on them as the season approaches, but right now, I'm just glad that this team is going to be back, pretty much a carbon copy of where they were last year, what they were last year. It doesn't happen often in the NBA, and the Brad Stevens era in Boston, it has been absolutely fantastic, and I cannot wait until next season where we hopefully will duplicate another final run like we did last year. On the contrary of the Celtics, the Boston Bruins are walking with their head cut off as a franchise, frankly. Don Sweeney and Cam Neely are seemingly hated by the entire fan base. Bruce Cassidy is fired by them and Jeremy Jacobs, who also doesn't seem to know what he's doing or seems to be following using Don Sweeney's eyes and not his own. And there really is no path or direction for the franchise at this point. It seems like we're waiting out Bergeron's retirement. Krejci obviously called it quits last season. There's debate whether he's coming back or not. Marchand is only getting older. Pasternak due for an extension next or this season and is due for free agency next year. This franchise is frankly on the brink of a collapse and of a rebuild that I don't think we've seen for a while. And ironically, it kind of all falls onto what I just briefly mentioned, whether Bergeron and whether David Krejci decide to run it back again. There's rumors from both of them, Bergeron more so than Krejci, that they will be returning to the Bruins this year on 1 year deals, low salary, high incentive, should say low base salary, high incentive. And quite frankly, I think Don Sweeney has yet to make any moves, has yet to do anything because he's waiting for confirmation between by those two. Pasternak discussions around an extension have begun, but I think they're waiting, frankly, to see if Bergeron and Krejci decide to help this team out for one more year. Because without them, the team looks absolutely gutted. With the injuries that we have, Brad Marchand and Charlie McAvoy will be out for a good portion of the first half of the season. Let's say about a fourth of the season, give or take. So they'll have to have their roles filled at least until mid to late November. And if you look at the center depth that the Bruins have struggled with for years, it's just non-existent. And even with the move, trading Arakawa for Pavel Zacha, it's a lateral move in the grand scheme of things. You get younger with Pavel Zacha, and trading an Arakawa who's 31 now. However, it doesn't help you create any depth down the middle. And Bergeron and Krejci are frankly way too crucial to the future of this franchise. At their age, they really shouldn't have this much of an effect on where this organization goes. But frankly, they do. And if both of them return, the team is set up for another playoff caliber season. If they decide to call it quits, this almost guarantees a rebuild, almost warrants a rebuild. The team will be strapped for cap, and they will have theoretically zero prospects coming up through the system. And with Pasternak due for an extension, all eyes will turn to him, and this will be a huge make or break moment for a franchise that's disappointed for the past decade or so. So I touched briefly on it in the previous segment, but David Pasternak is due for an extension next this year. He will become a UFA next year, which is not good because he is unrestricted, which means that any team will have the same rights as the Bruins. The Bruins cannot match any offer like they could if he was a restricted free agent. And talks have been somewhat quiet. I haven't heard too much in the past couple of weeks. There was rumors that right around the NHL draft, there was going to be some talks between Sweeney and Pasternak's team. I don't know what number they are going to be discussing. You know, it's hard to make comparisons in free agency. You just saw a good Johnny Gaudreau sign for, I believe, just over, this is 9.5, right around that mark. I think it's warranted Pasternak gets probably that or a little bit more. The number I threw out was 8 years, 9.5 per year. I think that probably gets bumped up to 10 if you're looking at where he slots in with the top players and where Johnny Gaudreau now slots in. I think he is a better player than Johnny Hockey, and he deserves more money. So I think an 8 for 10 is probably an offer that you'll see get thrown out. No matter what, I think you have to get this guy back. I think it's very similar to the Mookie situation with the Red Sox. And unfortunately, I don't think Mookie wanted to be here, and I think Pasternak does want to be here. But in terms of their effect on the team, you just simply cannot let a player of this caliber walk away. You can kind of honestly make a similar comparison to Rafael Devers and the influence he has on the franchise. But David Pasternak, he's been one of the best players in the NHL for a number of years. He came up through the system. He was one of the few picks that we had that has actually hit in the past couple of years, or you know, past 10 years or so. And frankly, he's all you have. Like we mentioned in that past segment, we don't have much in the prospect pipeline. And the last thing you can do is have your GM, who is hated by a majority of the Bruins fan base, push your best player and fan favorite into free agency. And it will be one of the worst situations ever documented in Bruins history and in Boston sports history. Similar to Tyler Seguin, similar to Mookie Betts, it will be an extremely tough day for Boston Bruins fans if Don Sweeney pushes David Pasternak into free agency. I still lean with on the side of he's going to be coming back. An extension will get done before the start of the season. But with every day that goes by with no extension, it makes me wonder. It makes me worried that the Bruins franchise is going to lose one of their best players in the past 5, 6 years. They're going to lose Patrice Bergeron to retirement. They have lost David Krejci to retirement. They're going to lose Brad Marchand to retirement. And you're left with Charlie McAvoy, Hampus Lindholm, and a bunch of misfits on the forward aspect for the next couple of years, aside from guys who are again getting older and Taylor Hall and such. The future is bleak for the Bruins, unfortunately. There is certainly room for them to turn it around with some trades, with some good picks. But the number one priority has to be to sign David Pastrnak back and do it quickly, and not risk run the risk of letting him slip to free agency unprotected. It would be a detrimental move for this franchise, and I can't even believe we're talking about it, and I can't believe Pastrnak is just less than a year away to leaving this team. We'll touch briefly on the Patriots to end the podcast. We'll definitely get more into them when the season begins, and even when the preseason begins, we can kind of see the talent and see the players on the field. At this point, we're kind of just waiting for training camp to start, and it's not much to talk about. But a lot of the headlines this offseason are headlined or centered around Mac Jones. A lot of reports suggesting that he has grown both mentally and physically as a player, and that he is going to really be a different quarterback than he was last season. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, a lot of reports are wrong in so many cases, and this is all kind of it seems more like this is opinionated than it is fact. You could say that Mac Jones mentally is stronger, but until he starts playing, in Gillette in December and in those types of games, you really can't tell. So I think that this is kind of a wait and see type of take from a lot of people. But it really will determine whether Mac Jones decides to slump or jump in his sophomore year. We've seen both sides of it. I think Justin Herbert had a fairly mediocre first year and then really exploded in his sophomore year, while Lamar Jackson had a really good year in his first season and then regressed greatly in his second year. We'll see which category Mac Jones falls into. The talent is lackluster yet again around him, both on the offense and defense. Belichick seems to have too much confidence in his quarterback, in his rookie, in his young quarterback, I should say. Whether that catches up to Mac Jones or not, we'll have to wait and see again. But it is good to hear that his teammates and that his coaches believe he's well on his way to taking a huge step forward, maturing in the league, becoming more physically adapted to the NFL. And if we see a similar season to last year, I'd say I call it a huge win with the cap we have set for next offseason, with Mac Jones being, I think, what, just 22 years old, 23. He's young. He's the future of the team. I don't think we're necessarily looking to win the Super Bowl next season, but rather compete like we did last year, improve the team. Let's see what type of talent we have. And certainly, Mac Jones will dictate how the Patriots perform. There are a number of teams, I think, out there, such as the 49ers, that can kind of cover up lackluster quarterback play and still perform at a high level. I don't think the Patriots have that luxury with the lack of talent, or the lack of strong talent, I should say, around Mac Jones. But I think Mac has the poise, and he realizes that, and he realizes he kind of determines how this team will go in this, how this team will perform in the second season under him. And again, I think the win-loss ratio is just it's way too big right now to determine where you think this team is going to finish. They could go and grab 12 wins and be a top seed in the East, or a top seed in the AFC, or they can I think sit at 500 very easily. I think we have to wait and see as we get closer to the season. There'll be a better, a more clear picture about who on offense, who on defense are going to be the playmakers, and we'll be able to kind of plan out what we'll need to have happen for the Patriots to succeed. Like I said, we're going to have a lot more Patriots talk as the season comes closer and closer. Now, I would like to thank you for listening. If you have made it the whole time, I appreciate it greatly. If you just listened to the Patriots segment, thank you as well. In the podcast notes, I will list our Instagram channel. Be sure to check it out. If you're interested at all in the content that we were talking about, we post all of it on our channel, and we have a lot of discussion. And we really enjoy, making a community out of the Boston sports world. So that's episode one. We'll be back next week with some more discussion about all things Boston sports. I've been your host, Jordan Haddock, and I will catch you.
She said, I think I'll go to Boston. I think I'll start a new life. I think I'll start it over. But no one knows my name. I'll get out of California. I'm tired of the weather. I think I'll get a lover. I'll fly him out to Spain. I said, I think